You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Yo, what's up? Welcome to Kind of Funny Games Daily for Tuesday, November 9th, 2021. I'm your host, Blessing Adeoye Jr. Joining me is the force that is Gary Whitta.
Good morning, Blessing. How are you?
I'm doing good, Gary. How are you doing?
I'm good. I enjoy hosting with you 2 weeks in a row now. I could get used to this Greg Miller, you know, being off the show. I feel like you and I got a good thing going. I'll be happy, but I'll also be sad when Greg comes back, because I feel like we're finding a little groove here, you and I.
Oh yeah, Gary, I love hosting with you because you're one of the co-hosts that always has like something to say, right? Like you always like have a thought teed up. You can go off about whatever I throw at you, and I feel like that is the sign of somebody who is fun to host with. And so I appreciate hosting with you, and I'm with you that like there's Greg being gone, I think, lends to a different energy for Kind of Funny content, because that means that I think we're a little bit more laid back and like chill and not as loud, even though we're still a company made up of very loud people, you know, like Scarpino and Tim Geddes and the whole crew is loud. None of us compared to Greg Miller in terms of loudness. He's very loud. And so there has been kind of this gap of like just non-loudness. And it, for me, it was evident this last weekend during Extra Life, where spoilers for the kind of funny Mario Party CEO tournament, where Barrett won the tournament and then gave the CEO status back to Greg Miller. And Greg Miller appeared for like a solid few minutes back on Kind of Funny Content, the rare appearance during his paternity leave era. And I forgot how loud this man is. I forgot the volume levels in which his voice can reach. And it is ridiculous, Gary.
I wonder if he'll come back after paternity leave a little bit quieter. Because one of the things that I learned with our first, and again, I've been reminded of just recently, because you know, we have a baby just turned a month old, is you do have to learn how to be, if you're, because I'm loud as well, I've got a very loud speaking voice, I tend to kind of crash around the house and generally, you know, just kind of be a bit of a bull in a china shop. And I know Greg's that same way as well, but you do have to learn to kind of keep your voice down, and you can't be kind of crashing and banging around the house. So I wonder if, I don't know if any of that, like, I guarantee you, like, Greg's learned to be quiet around the house. Greg, you need to be fucking quiet. The baby's asleep. Like, I wonder if you'll bring any of that energy back to the show.
I doubt it. No, because here's the thing, Gary, is that, yeah, he can be a gentle soul when he wants to, but the longer he does that, the more pent-up energy he builds.
Oh, and you're saying it's going to come back worse.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yes.
That's going to be his outlet.
Like, and that's why I wanted to keep him a CEO, because that's the shooting star, you know what I'm saying.
Gary, I want an update from last week, because last week on the show and on the post show we talked a bit about the games that you were looking forward to playing, and I think you mentioned games like Inscription and others. Is the update? Where are you at with video games?
I have a new game of the year. My personal game of the year has been usurped. I didn't think it was going to happen, because I was such a fan of It Takes Two, as you know. Leah and I played all the way through that. And I'm just so enamored with it. I think Joseph Farris is a genius. He's 3 for 3 now in my estimation. Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons, A Way Out, and now
It Takes Two.
He's found a way to kind of, you know, reinvent that two-player dynamic every time. And he just gets better and better at it every time. And no one is doing the two-player co-op stuff as well as him. And it is just every new level where they introduce like a new gameplay mechanic, I'm just like, more like, how does he come up with this stuff? Like, it's just so good. And for the longest time, I was saying, I've had the games this year that I really liked, but I remember saying for the longest time, like, nothing's like It Takes Two is like, just lock it in now. It's game of the year. I know there's small games coming, but like, nothing's going to topple it. It's happened though. I played something this weekend that is now my current game of the year leading candidate. It's at least tied with It Takes Two. Maybe it'll be like a joint winner for me personally this year. But I got to tell you, I finally got around to playing The Artful Escape. And it blew my motherfucking mind.
I was not expecting
never
that.
Played
that makes sense.
Anything like it. And I was just so impressed, so blown away. I can't wait to play it again. They're absolutely one of the most singular, unique, incredible, any kind of experience, movie, TV, video game, you name it. Just this epic fucking science fiction, rock, opera, insane thing. I don't even know how to explain it. It's so psychedelic. It's one of the best soundtracks I've ever heard. It's on Game Pass. You can finish it in pretty... I finished it in a day. 4, 5, 6 hours, depending on how you want to make your way through it. But just incredible. Just absolutely brilliant. Everyone's got to play it. The Artful Escape. Fucking loved it.
What if I told you that you were the second person out here at Kind of Funny
who has Artful Escape? Is it Tim Geddes, right?
Yeah, Tim Geddes has it as Game of the Year also, which, awesome.
It's going to be my Game of the Year. There's nothing else... Like, because all the other stuff that's left now is like the big AAA stuff. Like, you know, Vanguard I haven't played yet. Forza, Halo, Battlefield. But like, I'm sure those games are all going to be very good at what they do. Like straight down the middle, you know, highly polished AAA experience. But the games that catch my attention are the weird things that like no one else is going to make this game. You know, it's an Annapurna kind of thing. You know, they always, you know, do the weird games. And it's just this. It's up there with Journey as like one of those experiences that will always stay with. I'll be talking about this game 10 years from now in the same way that I still talk about Journey. Is like the first time I played through Journey, like that imprinted on me in a way. It's like, my God, this is one of the greatest experiences I've ever had with a video game. And I had that again with The Artful Escape. It's the most wildly imaginative, original, just deeply beautiful. It's poetic, it's soulful. It's got a great kind of underlying thematic story about, you know, being true to yourself and, you know, don't try to be who other people think, you know, that you should be or who they want you to be. Be who you know you truly are. And it's just this epic voyage of self-discovery. And it really does feel like this kind of trippy, psychedelic, like 1970s The Who type. Like, imagine like if like The Who and Pink Floyd and Douglas Adams and Terry Pratchett like all wrote a rock opera together, this is what you would get. And it's just absolutely stunning. I've been listening to the soundtrack ever since. Downloaded the soundtrack on Apple Music immediately after playing it. Can't wait to go back and play it again. I wish I'd have played it under better circumstances. I had to keep the volume low because, you know, we had the baby asleep while I was playing it over the weekend. But I want to go back and like play it with headphones, maybe get stoned because I feel like that's probably the best way to get most out, because it's very trippy, very psychedelic. It's just a beautiful, beautiful piece of art. It really is like one of those. It's one of those things where, I know, I feel like this conversation's like done and dusted now, but every now and again, it comes back again. Anytime someone tells you video games are not art or cannot be a work of art, fucking show them this. Like, it's just absolutely gorgeous.
I remember like playing through it and like the concept of it, of like this kind of coming of age story, but like using it, using like the almost like allegory of where rock was at, like going from like the late 60s into the 70s and having this main character kind of go on his like Ziggy Stardust journey. I thought it was like a really cool concept.
And maybe it doesn't appeal to everyone, but it hits like, you know, for me, because I'm a little bit older, like it hits all my personal favorite kinds of music that generally, you know, genres that these days are very underserved. Like it's obviously got this kind of Bob Dylan folk music kind of vibe, which is beautifully done. But then where the vibe really is, again, is this like this trippy kind of Pink Floyd, The Who, Rush, kind of, you know, like the kind of epic, like science fiction, odyssey, rock opera type stuff that was really popular in the 70s and really has never has been again. It's a very, very specific genre, but they nail it so well. It's so clear that the people who made this game love that very peculiar, very particular kind of music, and they just nail it. Just so well done.
I mean, that's kind of where I sit with it. I remember talking about it on the Gamescast during our review of it, and I had played probably about half of The Artful Escape, and I hit the point where I was like, okay, I get what this is, I appreciate it, I respect it, it's not for me. But the conversation that we did have was, if they made this for a genre that I cared way more about, I would see this game as an absolute masterpiece, right? Like, if they had this same exact thing, but it was for hip-hop, or if it was for old-school hip-hop or the transition between hip-hop generations, oh my God, I would be absolutely over the moon.
I could absolutely see, I could actually see this game, like, you could have taken this style of game and applied it to any kind of brilliant, you know, historical, you know, piece of, you know, it could have been about like the birth of hip hop, and that would have been an amazing version as well. But again, and that would have spoken to you. So I'm very lucky that they made the version of the game that speaks to me, which is that kind of 70s prog rock with kind of sci-fi, you know, the eras when, like, you know, the album covers look like the covers of like epic sci-fi novels, and they told like this really epic story. Like, it's so beautiful. And it's one of the reasons why I'm going on about it here is it's one of those games that is like so good, you want to immediately go out and become an evangelist for it. Like, why aren't more people talking about this game? Everyone should be losing their shit over what a beautiful work of art this game is. So I am going to be going full to the mat for this in every game of the year conversation I have between now and the end of the year. It Takes Two is still going to be up there. There's a bunch of others that that are bubbling under, you know, for my runners up. But unless something significant changes, Artful Escape is going to be my game of the year.
Now, Gary, have you played House of Ashes? Because you mentioned how much you love It Takes Two and how well that game handles co-op and how there's nothing else that really does it on that level. House of Ashes is one that I played yesterday, and I'm not going to compare it to It Takes Two in terms of how well done the co-op is, but as a co-op game, that's one that has caught me off guard that I think is really good, and I think more and more people are going to talk about as more and more people get their hands on it, because the Dark Pictures games leading up to this one haven't been as phenomenal. House of Ashes, finishing it last night, I am blown away by. Is this one that you checked out yet?
Yeah, and finally, I was literally just talking to Leah about it today. We've been looking to have that kind of, I said to her, hey, there's a whole genre of like cinematic horror games out there that you can play cooperatively. This could be like great for us because Leah likes horror. I have a slightly lower tolerance for horror. I get like creeped out really easily, but like when you're doing something together cooperatively, that kind of takes a little bit of the edge off of it. I was a big fan of Until Dawn. Haven't played any of the Dark. Was it been two previous games prior to this?
Manmadon and then Little Hope is the second.
Yeah, so I haven't played either of those, but I know they're all the kind of, again, the same kind of cinematic presentation, and there's like two player gameplay. This is the one because it's the first one that's optimized for next gen. The storyline seems to be the one that kind of could be the most interesting to me. We got it. We just picked it up last week, and I've been talking to Leah about it. Literally, we may start it tonight. Because I think it could be right up our alley. And I did see you tweeting about how you were a big fan of it. So that got me even closer. Like, we should push this up the queue. I think it's going to be the next thing we play.
Yeah, I was blown away by it. People will probably hear me talk about it on PS Love and other podcasts that come up. But the characters in this one, the places where the story goes, the places where the story ends up, even like there's things in like the credit scene that has me like, wow, they've really figured out what this franchise is in terms of Dark Pictures. And it does the thing where after you beat it, it plays the trailer for the next one. And as I was watching that trailer with my co-op partner, both of us were like, damn, it sucks that we're probably going to have to wait another year for this, because we were ready to jump into it right then. Like, we were super into it. And so, yeah, big shout out to Dark Pictures Anthology. And Gary, I want to talk to you about video games, like about the games that we've been playing.
I know,
playing.
We could do this all day, just having this generic video game chat.
And so maybe I'll save some for the post show. But for now, Gary, let me tell you about today's stories, which include Pokemon leaking all over the place, Sonic Frontiers possibly being open world, and more, because this is Kind of Funny Games Daily. Each and every weekday at 10 a.m. live right here on twitch.tv/Kind of Funny Games. We run you through the nerdy news you need to know about. If you're watching live, you can correct us when we get stuff wrong by going to kindoffunny.com/you'rewrong. If you don't want to watch live, you can watch later on youtube.com/kindoffunnygames, roosterteeth.com, or you can listen later on podcast services around the globe by searching for Kinda Funny Games Daily. Remember, you can use Epic Creator Code Kinda Funny on all Epic Store and Epic in-game purchases like Rocket League and Fortnite to help support the channel. To be a part of the show, at patreon.com/kindoffunnygames, or bronze members or above, get to write in, and silver members or above, get the show ad-free with the exclusive daily post show. Housekeeping for you, PSLW XOXO is up right now. It's Janet and I going through and creating our definitive PlayStation holiday shopping guide. That's up right now on youtube.com/kindoffunnygames and on podcast services around the globe. We also have a very long conversation about Bloodshore by Wills Interactive.
Oh, that's on my list too, largely Dude. Based on your recommendation. It's like kind of like a off-brand PUBG interactive movie, right?
Yeah, FMV, yeah, basically based on PUBG and other Battle Royale games. And I cannot wait to hear what you have to say about this game.
Did you enjoy it?
I loved it. And here's the thing. Wills Interactive, they put out a lot of FMV games. That's their shtick. That's their thing. Mm-hmm. And I played multiple of them at this point. The ones that I played and the ones that I've like heard impressions of and talked to Greg about before this point, I wasn't a big fan of. Complex was one that was more sci-fi. It was about a virus that they were trying to contain. That one, I had finished, and I was kind of like, all right, I really like FMV games, even the crappy ones, but this one right here is kind of like, it's kind of boring. It's not, the writing isn't good. It's not really doing it for me. Bloodshore leans into the campiness. It leans into the wackiness. It doesn't take itself seriously whatsoever. And because of how over the top it is, it ends up being fantastic.
It does look very campy. Really, I just watched the trailer. So let me ask you this, like these two, I mean, I remember these FMV, and so I kind of love that Wales Interactive is still making this. This is what almost kind of like a throwback genre, like to the first days of when CD-ROM first came out. like in the mid-90s, and they were like, oh, we can put FMV footage, you know, on a disc now, like video notes. It was low quality and grainy, but there was a period where like interactive movies, like that was the thing, and it ended up being kind of a dead end, and it wasn't the direction that people went in. Interactive storytelling did become a big thing, but like using full motion video is something now that only a handful of people are still doing, and I love that kind of Wales Interactive are still, you know, kind of like hitting, servicing, again, what I feel is almost like a retro genre now. It's a strange thing to say, but interactive movie in that very old-fashioned form is kind of like a retro genre again. Oh, yeah. Like the days of like CD-ROM in the mid-90s. But so let me ask you this: the two standards that I think you kind of judge these kind of projects by, as a movie, did you enjoy it? Like if you took the interactivity out and it was just a movie,
I get that it's a B movie.
I get that it's camp. I get that it's low budget. But like, can you enjoy it just on its own terms?
It's a bad movie. It is entertaining, though. If entertainment value means a lot to you, I think it is a fun watch just from the perspective of, wow, this is ridiculous. Wow, this acting is so, like, it's not up to par. Oh, man, the script is all over the place. But the ride they take you on, I think, is a fun ride. And then this might be your other standard that you're about to mention, but I think the thing that makes this game is the choices and is
right,
the
pitches. Yeah.
Yeah, like they nailed that.
Yeah, so that's yeah, that is the other part, right? Are the choices interesting, right? Do you feel like you're crafting your own version of the story through the choices? And are you kind of intrigued to know like what other versions of the story could have played out if you made different choices?
100% yes. I think this is one of those ones where it's almost like that. It's almost like they min-maxed it on the choices story, where the story is like whatever. It's entertaining, it's fun, but it's pretty bad. The choices in this game are actually really impressive. This is one of those games that only has like two choices per decision that you're making in the narrative. Mm-hmm. But the two choices are usually like the either or, right? Like it is the these are the two choices you'd want to make to really branch this thing out. And I was very impressed. We played this game on stream last week. I was so impressed that by the time we finished the game the first time around, because it's only an hour and a half long, we finished it and all of us were like, let's play this again because we want to see where else
this goes.
We want to see where the choices are going to take us. We played it again, and Gary, I kid you not, the second time we played through the game was completely different from the first. Like the first 30 minutes were the same, but we reached a branch point, like a major decision in the game that created pretty much an entirely different path and pretty much like allowed us to look at the game story through a different lens in a way that I thought was super impressive and made me want to go check out other Wales Interactive stuff. If this is the
that's interesting. Yeah, I like that. And I like the fact that it's, you know, it really does sound like, you know, you're not investing any more time than just watching a feature length movie, right? Cause that's basically the length of the experience. Yep. Seems like it would be a fun game to play either with other people on the couch, like, oh, you know, what choice are we going to pick? Or a fun game to stream with an audience as well, I feel like, where you can, like, you know, what do you want to do next chat, that kind of thing.
Exactly, and it does have a streaming mode where when you're playing regularly, it has, like, a timer for all your decisions. In streaming mode, it takes out that timer, so you can take as long as you want. You can put a poll in chat.
Interesting.
You can do all that stuff to allow your chat to help you make the decision. And so it's a perfect game for streaming. It's a really entertaining game.
That and House of Ashes, I think, in what order, I don't know, we'll get to them, but I think those might be the next two that we play.
Oh, hell yeah. And dude, I was talking about this last night with my friend Yami, who I was playing House of Ashes with. I was talking to her about like how much more I want these types of games, because I know they're somewhat niche in terms of not everybody is into choose your own adventure games, but between House of Ashes, Life is Strange, Bloodshore, and like the games we've gotten in the last decade, right, even the Quantic Dream stuff, Detroit Become Human, all that stuff, I want to see more of these types of games come out because I personally just really love them and I think they're super fun. And I get the feeling that we're not going to see as much of these games from Quantic Dream anymore. And I want somebody to take that place. I hope it could be Supermassive, but I want anybody to take that place of, hey, we are the ones that are throwing a bunch of budget into this thing, into a choose your own adventure game, because I think there's something there.
I know that Quantic Dream has kind of a mixed reputation, and Detroit Beyond Human ended up getting kind of, you know, a mixed reception. But I actually, one of the things that I liked about it was the same thing that you just mentioned about Bloodshore, was that I had no idea until I went back and like did different choices. It's not just like, oh, like here's basically the same ending but a different flavor of it, now this guy's dead. You can go down radically, radically different story paths with Detroit Beyond Human. I thought that was really impressive, you know, because they have to build out all those different versions of it, but you really can, like, you know, that you like ending A, ending B, ending C or whatever are like watching three completely different movies. Dude, not like the director's cut, like slightly different, like totally different. And I think that's really cool.
That's the argument I give. And we're going to get to the report soon. I know we're 20 minutes into the show, but like, that's the argument I give to Detroit Become Human. I've never really been a fan of David Cage's writing per se, but I do enjoy those games. And I think Detroit Become Human was the one that opened my eyes to, oh, I like the gameplay.
So I called it Beyond Human. So I don't know why I called, but yeah, Detroit Become Human. Yeah.
Detroit Become Human. I actually do like the gameplay. And I know we don't think of these games as gameplay driven, but in the games, the gameplay is the choices, right? The gameplay is the walking around and gathering information and making the informed decisions and doing the QTEs.
I like those kind of games, the Telltale games, the Quantic Dream games. I fucking enjoyed Heavy Rain.
Yeah.
Like they don't even have to be super good. I just like this, cinematic stories where I get to make choices. So even something as old fashioned as Bloodshot, and it is a very, very old fashioned style of game. Again, you're going back like 25 years. You're going back to like Sega CD and the first days. I remember when I was editor in chief of PC Gamer in like the early 90s, we were reviewing these games with like blocky FMV where you would make a left or right choice, and it was very basic. And the Bloodshot, it just seems like, I think like the artistry's gotten better in that, they're coming up with more interesting choices and the production values, now you're actually looking at like high definition video that's as good as you'd get on a Blu-ray instead of this kind of blocky pixelated stuff in a little window. But beyond that, like the actual the fundamental gameplay approach hasn't changed, but it's still fun. I know they're not for everyone, but for people like me that just like agonizing over choices and stuff, it still works really well.
Oh yeah. Thank you to our Patreon producers, Pranksy and Blackjack. We're still this early in the show. Today we're brought to you by Shin Megami Tensei 5, Credit Karma, Raycon, and Arcane, but we'll tell you about that later. For now, let's begin with what is and forever will be the Roper Report. It's time for some news. We have six stories today.
Epicers dozen.
Starting with our number one, Pokemon Brilliant Diamond and Shining Pearl have leaked early. This is Ethan Gotch at Kotaku. Game Freak's Pokemon Brilliant Diamond and Shining Pearl remasters aren't officially out for another 2 weeks, but some copies of the upcoming Nintendo Switch games have already started appearing out into the wild. Now fans are combing through apparent leaked screenshots and videos for signs of previously unannounced Gen 4 content, including the Battle Frontier and Distortion World areas. As first reported by VGC, a user claiming to have an early copy of the game posted about it on the PokeLeaks subreddit. While that user quickly deleted the post, more images and footage have started pouring out online in the past 24 hours since. Earlier today, for example, a YouTube account called PokeMasta uploaded a 2-minute video showing off Brilliant Diamond's town map and Pokedex. Another YouTube account, Poiter's Basket, has been uploading footage from the first few gym battles as well as Team Galactic fights. One thing players have noticed is MIDI-sounding music that differs from what's been shown in official trailers. It's unclear if that's an optional setting or placeholder music that will be swapped out in a day one patch. Leaked footage has also revealed new models, poses, and animations for some Pokemon like Bidoof and Murkrow. While players already largely know what's in the games since they've been pitched as faithful remakes of the originals, some also suspect they'll contain bonus content that Nintendo hasn't revealed yet in the recent marketing. The potential biggest prizes would be the inclusion of the Battle Frontier and Distortion World from Pokemon Platinum. Some footage has already been removed from YouTube, as Nintendo has in the past been aggressive at trying to stamp out leaks, especially when it comes to Pokemon. Back in 2019, Nintendo hired an outside firm specializing in forensics to track down the source of Pokemon Sword and Shield leaks. The leakers were eventually tracked down, taken to court, and forced by Nintendo's lawyers to pay a $150,000 settlement as well as legal fees. Gary, where do you stand with video game leaks like this?
I'm not a fan of leaks in general. I generally, because I know there's like some Spider-Man leak stuff happening this week as well, and stuff leaks out all the time, and I get it. There's a big, market out there. It's, leaks have a high commodity. I worked in the Star Wars universe for a long time where, there's a reason why we had all that security, because there's a massive market out there. These leaks have a high currency. People just want to see stuff early, even if it's like shitty quality, even if it's like, it's like a paparazzi type long lens picture, first look at a costume. For me, I would rather, let's say, for example, like a superhero costume, I would rather my first look at, you know, a new superhero costume or like the new bat suit or whatever it's going to be. I would rather that be like a proper photograph the way that the studio and the director wanted me to see it, rather than some like fuzzy shot that someone, you know, kind of shot with their iPhone from across the street or whatever. But that's me. The currency for these leaks is never going to go away. I do think it's unfortunate. I think it often undermines the intentions of the creators, people that make films, television, video games, any kind of art, work really, really hard to kind of present this stuff to you. Like when they work up to a whole strategy of, and here's how we're going to reveal it to the world in a way that it's going to give maximum impact and really kind of show off all the work we put into this in the best possible way. So when somebody jumps the gun and gets out ahead of that with like a shitty leak, it undermines that. And I know it can be really deflating for people that work in the development teams and then the creative teams of these projects. Like, ah, oh, fuck, we worked so hard to like make this a cool reveal, and this is how it gets, someone undercuts us, and this is how it gets out. What a bummer. It is a bummer.
Yeah, I think these leaks right here are the worst types of leaks, where we're a couple weeks out from the game and the things that are leaking aren't necessarily things that are big and newsworthy, right? These aren't like, hey, this X studio has started development on the next BioShock or the next Half-Life or something that is a piece of news that is going to serve fans in a way that, right, you know, might take a little bit away from the actual announcement, but not in a way that does everybody a disservice, right?
But like the actual material, yeah, that's a different thing.
The fact that the games are out there and people are just uploading the images of like different Pokemon poses and uploading footage of like gym battles and all the things that I think come with the excitement of being able to get your hands on the game for the first time and play it through and go, oh man, like I get to experience this for the first time or re-experience this for the first time or see everything in real time as opposed to scrolling through Twitter and seeing leaks pop up on your timeline. I do think that sucks. I think like in terms of leaks overall, I think there is a range to them, and there's like a gray area there that I don't have a hard stance on. I think there are leaks that are good leaks. I think there are leaks like this one that are bad leaks. And I think there are leaks in between that we can have a conversation about whether certain things are necessary or certain things like, do we need to have E3 leaks a week beforehand that like are the drop of the trailer of the game that's about to come out? I think that is more of a discussion than a either or kind of thing. But yeah, these kind of leaks suck.
With Pokemon in particular though, and I'm going to try really hard not to sound condescending here, but I'm sure I'm going to do that anyway, despite my best efforts. All I can do is be a little bit amused by it. First of all, these are, as I understand, these are remakes of older games, yes, right? So I'm not sure like how substantial these leaks can really be, right? Because they're just reinterpretations, remakes of things that everyone's in the Pokemon universe already knows about. But aside from that, I don't know. I mean, these are games for little kids, man. Like my daughter's almost 10 years old, and she doesn't talk about Pokemon nearly as much as she used to because she's aging out of it. She's almost 10 years old. And so to see like grown ass men getting bent out of shape about Pokemon leaks, I don't know. I just find it kind of funny.
Yeah, I think it's interesting when people pick apart these types of leaks, because I think that's been a big thing that's been going on social media and on Reddit and forums and all these things. People look at the leaks and they look at the things that they may that they'll say are missing from the game or things that are in the game, and they judge the game based on that as opposed to judging the game based on the final product that they actually have their hands on. And I know Pokemon fans can be very split because there's a lot of, I think Imran Khan was the one that mentioned this on Twitter, that the Pokemon fan base is an interesting one because there are essentially 8 generations between all the different game releases of Pokemon fans that have touched the game in different ways and have different expectations for what that game is going to include or what a new Pokemon game should include. And so because you have so many different fractured expectations, it is so difficult to please everybody at the same time because people just have wildly different ideas for what this thing should be. In terms of this leak, right, it seems like the biggest things, at least on a news level, are the Battle Frontier and the Distortion World areas. And the Battle Frontier, I believe, is like the Pokemon Tower after you beat the game, where you just go through and do a bunch of rooms of Pokemon battles. And then the Distortion World, I believe, is like a dungeon-type area for Pokemon, which, you know, those are cool things. And I think those were the unexpected things that came in this game, because with these Pokemon remakes, Nintendo often does put things in here and there that may have been different from the original games, or maybe bonus content, or maybe content that came on later in the franchise that they want to implement in this earlier game because people liked it. Stuff like that, I think, can be exciting to like see and check out and get hyped for. But if those are meant to be surprises, I feel like those should have stayed as surprises.
You're right. And even as I'm listening to you and I'm thinking about like what I just said, like I really didn't mean to sound condescending. Like people should love what they love. You know, there's all kinds of stuff that's primarily aimed at kids that I still really enjoy. Like Bluey is one of my favorite shows on television. That's for little kids. And I think there is a nostalgic, you know, Pokemon's been around for a long enough time now that a lot of adults who are playing it are playing it because they played it since they were little kids, and it reconnects to their inner child. And, you know, they are good games. They're well-designed games. People enjoy them. And I think if anything excites you or excites your inner child or makes you feel like a kid again, or you just derive any kind of joy from it, whatever your age is or whatever, people shouldn't mock you for that. Mm. And you should enjoy what you enjoy, apart from Kingdom Hearts fans. There's no fucking excuse for that under any circumstances.
We had to mention that. Yeah, no, Kingdom Hearts, get out of here. But, I mean, to your point, Gary, I'm somebody who is I'm looking forward to playing Pokemon Brilliant Diamond and Shining Pearl. Like, I cannot wait to get my hands on this, because this is gonna be my first time playing this generation specifically. That said, I look at these leaks, and I can probably look through all of these leaks, and none of it is going to affect me, because I have zero expectation in terms of what I think a Pokemon game needs, right? I'm just here to play Pokemon. I'm just here to catch them all and have a good time. And I think to the point you're making in terms of the type of game that Pokemon is, I think the salient point there is the fact that it isn't like a Star Wars game, right? It isn't like a Last of Us. It isn't a game. And I mean, we can compare it directly to The Last of Us leak, because The Last of Us literally leaked. The Last of Us Part 2 leak was disastrous because story stuff was coming out all over the place. There were, of course, big story moments that happened in that game. And there was conversation around that. And people had to try their hardest to avoid that. With Pokemon leak, nobody really cares about Pokemon on a... Let me back up a little bit. People don't care about Pokemon, I guess, as comparative to something like Last of Us in terms of the story moments of Pokemon. I'm sure there are plenty of people out there that are like, hey, I want my story. Hey, like, I look forward to the story, and that's whatever. But
And by the way, that's the other side of it, Blessing. I was talking earlier about how, like, it affects the development team. And I remember when that Last of Us leak happened, like, you know, Druckmann and all the Naughty Dog people were really bummed out about that. They didn't want that shit to get out that way. But it's also a bummer for us, right? There are people out there that are interested in leaks and want to see everything as soon as they can find it. But then there's people like us, certainly like me, who, again, I want to experience this the right way. I don't want to see it ahead of time. I don't want to be spoiled. I don't like spoilers. I don't like leaks. And we live in a culture now where, you know, everyone's kind of muting like 50 different hashtags, trying to, you know, kind of dodge all these leaks that are coming at them through social media. And you'll still find some way to like get screwed over. Like, oh man, I muted 50 different hashtags, but there was like one thing that still got through the net, and now I've seen it and you can't unsee it. And that's spoiled for me now. And it's a bummer. I think that leaks service far fewer people than they spoil things for, if that makes sense. The number of people that are really interested in leaks and that culture and that currency are far outweighed by people who are like, you know what, just I want to see it when, under the right circumstances, when it's time to see it. Don't spoil me. I want to experience this the right way. The Last of Us one, I remember being really unfortunate. That's just one of many examples.
Oh, yeah. Gary, I want to hop into story number two, but before I do, I want to remind everybody out there that they can go to patreon.com/kindoffunnygames where they can get the show ad-free. And speaking of ads, let us tell you about our sponsors.
This episode is brought to you by Arcane, a Netflix original series from the creators of League of Legends. Arcane is a 9-episode, 3-part series that follows the story of two young girls, Vi and Powder, born in the Undercity beneath Piltover. Their eagerness to prove themselves will set in motion a series of events that will take the relationship to its breaking point and transform them forever. This is going to be the animation event of the year, and you can catch champions we know and love like never before, and their stories will all intertwine in this action-packed series. Whether you're a longtime League player or brand new to Runeterra, Arcane is a great way to get to know the vast world and origins of iconic characters of League of Legends. Dive into the stories behind one of the most played games of all time. Every once in a while, I think about that and it blows my mind. Discover the secrets of Piltover and its Undercity and prepare for the epic battle that is only just beginning. Arcane is now streaming exclusively on Netflix. Next up, shout out to Credit Karma. Is it time for a big change? If you're thinking about home renovations or finally paying down those old credit card bills, Credit Karma can help find a loan that works for you. Whether you're refinancing credit card debt or paying for an upcoming expense, Credit Karma uses your credit data to show you fresh personal loan offers that are personalized just for you. It's totally free and easy to sign up for a Credit Karma account with no effect on your credit score. On Credit Karma, you can check out multiple loan offers side by side with easy to compare estimated terms to make sure you get the best deal. And once you've got a loan, Credit Karma will help you track your progress as you pay off your debt and even let you know if you can can refinance and save. If you're ready to apply, you should head over to creditkarma.com/loan offers to see personalized offers with your approval odds right now. Go to creditkarma.com/loan offers to find the right loan for you. That's creditkarma.com/loan offers. Next up, shout out to Shin Megami Tensei 5. It's the newest installment in the acclaimed JRPG series developed by Atlus. You play as a high school student who is suddenly transported from modern-day Tokyo to a post-apocalyptic world. Granted a cursed power to save his life, the protagonist becomes a new being, neither human nor demon. Nahobino. So there you go. Explore the demon-infested wasteland of an enigmatic realm known as Da'at, filled with mythical deities and demonic tyrants in constant conflict for survival. Search for answers and forge your own path in a battle between light and dark. Your choices will dictate the fate of the world. Turn formidable foes into worthy allies by recruiting them, then fuse them to create demons customized to your playstyle. Shin Megami Tensei 5 has been fully rendered in 3D, a first for the mainline Shin Megami Tensei series. Shin Megami Tensei 5 is out now. You can check out the digital, deluxe, and standard editions on the Nintendo eShop or by clicking in the link in the description. And finally, shout out to Raycon. It's never too early to start holiday shopping, especially not when you can save big on a gift that they'll use every day, like the Raycon wireless earbuds. My brother's been using these. He's been training for his marathon, and he's been jamming with the Raycons. With seamless Bluetooth pairing and a comfortable noise-isolating fit, you can start listening easily and keep listening for hours. The audio quality is just as good as a bunch of the other premium brands, but at half the price. Their new everyday earbuds come with 3 new sound profiles to make sure everything you're listening to sounds its best. Pure, more balanced mode, and bass mode. And with 8 hours of playtime and a 32-hour battery life, you can't lose. Go to buyraycon.com/KFGD today to unlock exclusive deals up to 20% off your Raycon order. But hurry, this offer is available only for a limited time and you don't want to miss it. That's buyraycon.com/KFGD to unlock up to 20% off your Raycons. buyraycon.com/KFGD.
I like this season. I like this much better than first season. Sorry. Which one about Demon Slayer during the break?
Yeah, no, I think the ad cut early, and so the people got some good Demon Slayer.
Yeah, I miscalculated. I'm sorry. Hey, I had a timer going. You know,
it happens.
You know,
if you can make a note for like a post edit, we can figure that out later. But for now, let's talk about story number 2. Is the next Sonic game open world? I'm pulling from Andy Robinson at VGC, who put up an article yesterday after we actually talked about this a little bit on KFGD. Because if you remember, if you listened to yesterday's KFGD, the news story there was that Sega had trademarked Sonic Frontiers. Coming off of that, we now have this write-up from Andy Robinson that is, Sega's Sonic Frontiers trademark seemingly corroborates open world claims. The article reads like this. Sega has filed a trademark for Sonic Frontiers, which looks likely to be the name of the next mainline entry in its flagship series. The Japanese trademark for Sonic Frontiers was filed late last month, a listing on the country's trademark body has revealed. The timing may be significant, as the trademark was filed after it was claimed online that the next entry in the series would be called Sonic Frontiers and feature an open-world setup. In May, Sega teased plans to release a new mainline Sonic game in 2022 for PS5, PS4, Xbox Series X, Xbox One, Switch, and PC. Based on metadata referencing files used in the production of Sega's teaser trailer, it was previously suggested that the new series entry would be called Sonic Rangers. However, on October 17th, several days before Sega's trademarks were filed, an anonymous leaker claimed via Reddit that the name of the game had been changed to Sonic Frontiers. They also said it would be an open-world game similar in style to The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. Sonic Team head Takashi Iizuka has said he'd like the game to have the same lasting impact as Sonic Adventure. In a Sonic Stadium interview published in June, the franchise's creative officer said he hoped the upcoming game would provide the building blocks for the future Sonic titles for many years to come. Gary, does the idea of an open-world Sonic game do anything for you?
I would reserve judgment on that until I knew more about how it's being implemented, because I don't know. It's like, we've gotten to a point where like open world is just kind of like a catch-all term for like I get it. Open world's so hot right now. Everything's open world. You know, Forza Horizon, you know, is predicated entirely on, you know, everyone's playing that right now. I've been playing for the last week. Open world. It's huge. There's so many things to do. I don't know. I remember with the Burnout games, when Burnout went open world with Burnout Paradise, that's when I actually started to tune out a little bit. I just kind of feel like the experience is almost less curated when it becomes open world. I like the fact that you can go anywhere and do whatever you want, but like I'm playing Forza right now And honestly, I find it a little bit overwhelming just how open world it is. Like, there's so much to do. There are so many fucking choices that I almost
You finish one event and then unlock a bunch of others. And it's like,
I get that same kind of paralysis that I get when I'm scrolling through Netflix. There's so many fucking things to watch. It's impossible to pick one thing. And the game is, hey, Gary, every fucking 5 seconds. You want to do this? You want to do that? I'm driving down the road. Want to spin a fucking fruit machine wheel? Want to do this? Want to do that? And go over here and go over there. Like, fucking just let me go somewhere. Just let me pick one thing. And so I don't know. It gets to a point where open world games, I think, can get a little bit overwhelming with how much they throw at you and how much just choice you have. Sometimes I just want like a more curated experience. Like the game's telling me, go do this now, go do that now. Now you're going to do this race. Now you're going to do that race. That's kind of like a more old fashioned formula. But sometimes I just want the game to kind of be designed for me and tell me what it wants me to do next. And I'll go do that thing. There's very, very different schools of thought on this. And I think, you know, the open world is not good or bad. It's how do you implement the open world? And we know that because we've seen good open worlds and bad open worlds, and good implementations and bad implementations. So something like Sonic, I could certainly see how it could work. But again, I'll reserve judgment on it until I see how they actually implement it and execute it. But I don't think that like open world is just is a necessary evolution of every kind of game. Like,
I agree.
Racing games eventually have to go open world. Sonic game, platform games, they all eventually have to go open world. You have to look at the kind of game and what's the foundation of the universe and the character and the world that you have and ask yourself, is an open world execution appropriate for this particular game? It's not inevitable in every case.
And that last sentence right there is exactly why I look at this and I go, do I want this? Is this something that gets me excited? Because I love Sonic, as you know, Gary, and as many people know. I also love Breath of the Wild. And here's my thing. I do this all the time, and I am probably the world's biggest culprit when it comes to this, because I'm Breath of the Wild's number one fan. I stand Breath of the Wild. It's my favorite game of all time. We got to stop comparing every single open world game to Breath of the Wild, because a Sonic the Hedgehog open world game is not going to be anything like Breath of the Wild. That doesn't make sense. How in the world do you do that? I think the way that this would make sense is if you have a Sonic game that is something more akin to like Mario Odyssey, where it is open levels and you're going through and you're collecting Chaos Emeralds or Golden Rings or something along those lines. I think that could make sense and that could be exciting. I like the idea of a Sonic game that is... thank you, Bear, for bringing up this infamous photo, which is us in the Sonic outfits. A Sonic game that is about exploration and is about discovery and is about, all right, cool, like, let me go look behind this tree over here. Oh, cool, I got a golden ring. Or let me go do this, like, mini obstacle course that was created over here, right? Something along the lines of what Mario Odyssey does for their levels makes sense. And even Mario Odyssey, that's not an open-world game, right? That's a game that is divided by levels, that has open levels and open-level design, but, like, that makes sense for this type of game. I don't know if I necessarily want a 3D platformer like Sonic to be fully open world, because I just don't think that makes sense. I like the idea that they are thinking about Sonic in a bigger and better way. I like the idea that they are shifting what Sonic the Hedgehog is and trying to figure out what the next step for it is. I love the idea that Takashi Iizuka from the Sonic team said that he wants this game to have the lasting impact of Sonic Adventure. Those are all the things that I want to hear from the folks behind Sonic for a franchise that has been struggling a lot over the years, right?
Yeah.
You never know what you're going to get with Sonic the Hedgehog. Sonic the Hedgehog is the box of chocolates of video games, of franchises.
Yeah, that's the thing. I kind of feel like over the years, Sonic has been, it's become such an omnipresent franchise, you know, and such an omnipresent character that it really, that it's been shoehorned into every kind of, like, what particular genre has not been checked? Like fucking survival horror. Actually, I would fucking love that.
That would be sick.
Survival horror Sonic game. That I would fucking sign up for.
run like, from the horror.
But you know, 2D, 3D, you know, fucking pinball, you know, there's a Sonic fighting game, Sonic racing games,
multiple of them.
Fucking yeah, match three. Game. Puzzles. They've
been
done
the Olympics.
They've done everything. So it makes. So I guess it kind of. It's depressing, but I guess it's going to make sense that, like, you know, open world is just like the next box they need to check. And again, knowing what we know about kind of the underpinnings of the Sonic universe and the gameplay style, I don't think open world is inherently like, oh, I don't see how that would fit. Sure, it could fit if you do it right, but let's wait and see.
Exactly. Gary, let's keep talking about how 3D platformers can further expand with story number 3. Miyamoto wants the next 3D Mario game to further expand the series. This is Chris Scullion at Video Games Chronicle. Shigeru Miyamoto has stated that Nintendo wants to expand further when developing the next 3D Mario game. Speaking during a Q&A following the publication of its latest financial results last week, Miyamoto said that the success of Super Mario Odyssey had made it clear that the company was succeeding in its attempt to make 3D Mario games playable by a larger audience. When asked about the differences between 2D and 3D Mario games, Miyamoto explained that the new Super Mario Bros. Series was designed to create a Mario game that was accessible to players of all skill levels, because the 3D games weren't at the time. Quote, "Let me explain by describing the background for the development of the Wii game, New Super Mario Bros. Wii, which was released in 2009, Miyamoto said. He continues, quote, "At the time, it felt like each time we created a new installment in the Super Mario series, which by then had expanded into 3D, it became more complicated. After the release of Super Mario Galaxy in 2007, the goal was to develop a more accessible 3D Super Mario game, and the result was New Super Mario Bros. Wii, a basic side-scrolling Super Mario game that even new players could easily play. That later led to the release of the even simpler Super Mario Run game, a mobile application released in 2016. When we develop software, we strive to incorporate new elements, but at the same time, we want to make it easy for even first-time players to have fun. Recently, people of all generations have been enjoying the 3D Mario game Super Mario Odyssey, released in 2017. So for 3D Mario going forward, we want to try to we want to try expanding further in new ways," end quote. With nearly 22 million titles sold to date, Super Mario Odyssey is the best-selling 3D Mario game by a significant margin. The second best-selling is Super Mario Galaxy, with sales of 12.8 million. Garrett, how much do you like Super Mario Odyssey when that came out in 2017? And are you looking forward to the idea of them further expanding?
It's close to, if not tied, for my favorite Mario game next to Super Mario Galaxy. I thought Odyssey was fantastic. Yeah, and it's interesting to kind of think about the kind of historical evolution of the Mario series. And I'm very interested and intrigued by what Miyamoto is saying here in terms of like taking the next, you know, step in terms of its evolution. You know, the history of the Mario franchise has been this kind of cross between, you know, evolution and revolution, right? You know, we had the original kind of 2D Mario games, and they got better and more interesting. Super Mario Brothers, Mario 3, Mario World, and they got more, and they basically got better and better at refining the 2D, you know, play style. Mm-hmm. And then Miyamoto completely revolutionized it with Super Mario 64, right, and reinvented what a Mario game could be. And then ever since then, they've been evolving that, right? Sunshine, Galaxy, Odyssey, basically the same essential kind of 3D quasi open world play style that they introduced with Mario 64. They're just getting better and better and better at it. And Odyssey represents kind of like the latest kind of refinement of that evolution. But maybe what Miyamoto's thinking about and hinting at, I mean, I can't really say, because I don't have his fucking galaxy brain. I wish I was fucking one-tenth as the genius that he is. But what he might be thinking of now is like, okay, so we invented Mario, we evolved it to a fine point, and then we completely revolutionized it with Super Mario 64, and we've evolved that to the finest point. What is the next revolution? And I can't even imagine what that might be, but maybe that's what Miyamoto is hinting at here.
Yeah, I think this makes sense for Miyamoto. I think this is the way they think about all their games, all their major games at the very least. With Mario, with 3D Mario, there's always some kind of innovation or gimmick thrown in to try and make it either more palpable or more interesting. And that's the thing I like a lot about Nintendo and the way they design their games. Whenever they're creating a new big Mario game, I think they're always asking the question, what is going to take this a step further? Or what is going to take this a step aside? What is going to separate this from the others? Even with something like Super Mario Galaxy and Super Mario Galaxy 2, Galaxy 2 had enough there that I would call that an innovation over Mario Galaxy 1. I won't say like one is better than the other, but like the addition of Yoshi adds a lot to that game. Turning like the hub area into like a ship and having it be more of a like course selection style thing, like that is a shift that they didn't necessarily need to do. People loved Mario Galaxy 1. They could have just made another Mario Galaxy 1 and just added more levels, and they didn't need to like do much to it to make people go, okay, cool, yeah, I want more of this, I love this. But even with that like incremental entry into that series, they still did enough there that I would say makes it stand out in terms of what the mechanics are. And then you get into things like Super Mario Odyssey, which is a big step. And you know, given what Miyamoto's saying here about trying to further expand and the popularity of Super Mario Odyssey and how that is making them look towards the next 3D Mario and figure out how to make that palpable to even more people, I wouldn't even be surprised if the answer was Super Mario Odyssey 2, but with a new gimmick or some kind of thing added in to make it stand out and make it even more interesting than Mario Odyssey 1. I'm totally down for this. I love that the numbers are I love that the numbers for Mario Odyssey are actually really good compared to the previous 3D Mario games. It's not the biggest surprise because the Switch is such a popular platform, but I think for Nintendo, they look at that 22 million copies sold number and they go, cool, we can like continue to put these out at a regular pace. We don't have to wait as long between 3D Mario games. We can continue to give people what they want, and this makes sense for us on a business level to keep putting these things out at a regular pace, which I just, has me excited.
I just think that Miyamoto is thinking in a more visionary and forward-thinking way than just, you know, okay, what's the next gimmick we can bolt onto Odyssey? Like, what's the next way that we refine that? Again, I go back to Mario 64. I remember I was editor-in-chief of PC Gamer back in the day when Super Mario 64, we had Next Generation magazine was next door to us, and they did the console games. And I remember the day it came in, and I heard this commotion, like, oh my God. It's like, I go, what is that? I went over there to see what it was. And everyone was crowded around the Nintendo 64 watching someone play Super Mario 64. And everyone's minds were fucking blown by it because nobody saw that coming. Nobody even imagined that that reinvention into a 3D world was even possible or something that would be the next logical step. Like, Nintendo came out of nowhere and fucking blew everyone away with how amazing that they reinvented the Neo. Up until then, no one really thought beyond, like, you know, Mario as a 2D world, the side-scrolling world. And then it was a complete and utter reinvention, and it worked so well, and it was so brilliant that we were just so blown away. Nobody saw it coming. And so what I want to believe is that what Miyamoto's got his eye on now is that next thing. What's the next revolutionary evolution of the Mario gameplay world that when we see it, we go, holy fuck, who could have seen this coming?
Did you play Bowser's Fury?
Yes, I liked it.
Do you think that is a hint toward the next Mario game? Because that was the one that shifted. I mean, we talk about open world platformer, right? That was literally an open world 3D platformer in the way that I was talking about a little bit with Sonic and how I don't necessarily know if I want that. They figured that out and actually made it work and actually really liked Bowser's Fury. I thought Bowser's Fury was a really cool idea, and it felt almost like a testbed for, we can go further with this, we can implement this in our next game. Do you think there's something there, or do you think Bowser's Fury was just Bowser's Fury? It's locked in DLC for this other game.
I mean, the thing that's interesting about Bowser's Fury and Mario Maker and all these other things, that they are always like exploring something different. You know, Mario is their Mickey Mouse, like it's their core franchise. They know they can sell Mario games all day long, and they could very much rest on their laurels and just put out, you know, 2D and 3D Mario games, refinements of the kind of the base gameplay foundations that we have forever, and they can make a lot of money. But again, I don't think Miyamoto's satisfied with that. I think Miyamoto has got like one big magic trick left. This is made the romantic in me. This is what I want to believe.
Oh man.
I want to believe that Miyamoto's got one big magic trick left in his bag before he retires. Because, you know, he's going to retire one of these days. He's getting older. Like, you know, he's got nothing left to prove, right? Probably one of the true ultimate legends of the video game industry, and is going to be enshrined in the Hall of Fame for all time. Like, he's number one. And so he's got nothing left to prove. But the thing about like super genius types like that, who are like compelled to like keep creating and keep finding the next frontier, is that even though he's got nothing left to prove, he's going to fucking do it anyway. And I think that there is, again, it's the romantic in me speaking. I just want to believe that there is one more thing where we go, holy shit, he's fucking done it again. And then and then he'll go sit on a beach somewhere, and he's earned it.
I hope so. Yeah. I mean, I just got so excited off of you just saying that alone. Like, I'm thinking about it. I'm like, man, what if he did have another Mario 64 in him, right? Or what if he had another like all time classic game in him that he drops in one of the franchises that we love? I hope so. I hope so.
Yeah.
Gary, I'm going to go through these next few stories quickly because we are late in the show. Mm-hmm. So story number four, Deathloop's director has been appointed as the new head of Arcane Leon. This is Tom Ivan at Video Games Chronicle. The co-director of Deathloop has been appointed as Arcane Leon's new studio head. Dinga Bakaba took on the role of studio director at the company in October following the departure of former head Romuald Caprone. Bakaba has also retained his position as Arcane Leon's co-creative director, a role he shares with Deathloop co-director and studio art director director, Sebastian Mitten. Arcane Leon's new studio head joined the developer in November 2010. He's credited as a designer and producer on Dishonored and its DLCs, as lead designer on Dishonored 2 and Death of the Outsider, and as game director on Wolfenstein Youngblood. Bacaba's predecessor, Caprone, stepped down in October shortly after the launch of the studio's latest game, the critically acclaimed Deathloop, and 7 months after Arcane's parent company, ZeniMax Media, was acquired by Microsoft. So big congratulations to Dinga. That is awesome. And like Dinga seems awesome too. Like I've watched plenty of his interviews. I've seen him on Twitter. I follow him on Twitter. And he seems like a delight whenever I see him pop up. And so big congrats there. Story number five, The Tomorrow Children is making a return. This is Daniel Robson at IGN. 5 years after its October 2016 release as a free-to-play game on PS4 and subsequent shutdown 13 months later, The Tomorrow Children is set to return. Q Games, the Kyoto-based indie developer behind the game, has acquired the rights from publisher Sony Interactive Entertainment, returning The Tomorrow Children IP to the creator, Dylan Cuthbert, and his team. During a rare private server gameplay video in September 2021, Q Games CEO and founder Cuthbert told IGN Japan that he hoped to acquire the rights and re-release The Tomorrow Children if Sony would allow it. A small but vocal audience has called for its return since public servers were closed in November 2017, rendering the game unplayable. And Cuthbert says it was this dedication from fans that convinced him to pursue negotiations with Sony over the rights. Quote, I'd like to thank, first and foremost, the fans of The Tomorrow Children, without whom I would never have had the confidence to keep pursuing the deal, Cuthbert said in an announcement today. He continues, our fans are some of the most amazing gamers out there, and every day for the past 4 years, they have kept the dream alive. I think the happiest thing about this decision is imagining the enjoyment those fans will feel as they re-enter the crazy post-apocalyptic neo-Soviet world of The Tomorrow Children. Secondly, I'd like to thank Sony Interactive Entertainment for also working with me to have the IP returned to Q Games. It has taken a concerted effort by all of us to get to this ultimate step, and I'm full of gratitude to everyone involved in the process, end quote. The Tomorrow Children was an online-only multiplayer experience in which players collaborated to build towns, farm resources, and protect the world from attackers, all set in a surreal Soviet-infected post-apocalypse. I'm gonna stop there. There's more to the article. Go to IGN if you want to check out more and get more context for it. But, Gary, did you ever play or were you ever familiar with The Tomorrow Children?
No, but it sounds cool, and I just want to say in general, fair play to the developers to... for getting it back. It's a very, very hard thing to do from a legal, you know, financial standpoint, whatever. That once you sell the rights to something to a big company, getting it back can be very, very difficult to do. And it can be very expensive and those negotiations can be very hard. So Fair play to them for like navigating that maze and getting it back. It's a very, very hard thing to do. But I understand why companies like and developers like this want to do it. It can be heartbreaking. Like you sell the rights to something to a big company in the hope that that will represent like the next step. You know, he's going to take your game to the next level, but it doesn't always happen, right? Sometimes those big companies will buy a game and they won't fully support it. They're just going to stick it on a shelf and not really get behind it. And now you're stuck. Oh man, I worked really, really hard to like develop this thing that I love. It's my creation. Sold it to this company, and now they're just like doing nothing with it. That's kind of heartbreaking. Like, give it back to me. I'll do something with it. But again, it's not always easy to get the company to kind of let it revert to you. So well done to them, and I hope they're able to, you know, do more with it than Sony was apparently willing to do.
Yeah, I think this is awesome. You know, The Tomorrow Children was one that I never had a big interest in. I would always see the trailers and go, oh, that has a cool art style, but I don't know if this game is necessarily for me. And I think it having a small player base probably spoke to the fact that it just wasn't that widely, like, people weren't widely excited about it, right? It was this PlayStation first party game that came out, didn't really make waves. I think people just looked at it and went, what is this, and kind of moved on from it. And so it makes sense that it went away, but I do think that it is awesome, to your point, Gary, that the creator can go to Sony and go, hey, can I have this back? Like, can you give this back to me? Can we make a deal so I can actually do something with this because I care about this? And it reminds me of when Square Enix and IO Interactive split, and Square Enix let IO Interactive have Hitman. Like, that is not a thing that companies usually do, right? I think the move for big companies like that is to hold on to an IP that they believe is valuable. And I know Tomorrow Children isn't necessarily a valuable IP, but any IP can be valuable, right? Like, that is something that usually you keep in your pocket.
Here's the thing. One of the reasons why I think it's hard to do is, even if a company like Sony doesn't believe that a particular property that they own has a lot of potential, which is why they're letting it sit on a shelf, they don't want to give it back to someone else in case if they then go have a big hit with it, that makes Sony look bad. It's like, oh, you weren't able to kind of have the vision for this game that we were then able to go do, sold it to another company. And they, you know, it's always embarrassing. Like, you know, all the publishers that turned down Harry Potter or all the actors that turned down Neo in The Matrix, like, oh man, why couldn't I see what someone else saw? There was big potential there. And we let it, you know, go across the street and someone else had a big hit with it after we turned it down. That makes the people that turned it down look bad. So there is some risk associated for Sony and companies like that when they let something revert, because you know, there's some kind of reputational risk involved. So good for them for doing it.
Hell yeah. Let's round out with story number six. One of my favorite things to do on this show is to like find a new game or a trailer that drops that makes me go, oh shit, I didn't know about this before, and not many people, this came out of nowhere, let's share it with the audience. And yesterday a trailer dropped for a game called Lives of P, which looks really cool. And so Barrett, I have the trailer if you want to pull it up. You can play without sound, and I'll read through a story. Listen, that is pulled from Wesley Yinpool.
I need to remind you. You never need to tell me when to pull up. I got it, buddy.
Barrett, I'm not even saying it for you at this point. I'm saying it for the audio listeners to tell them to, hey, come watch the video version, because hey, there's a trailer playing right now and this trailer is dope.
Then talk to them, buddy.
All right, listen, audio listeners, come to the video. The trailer for this game is dope. Again, the game is called Lives of P. I'm going to pull an article from Wesley Yinpool at Eurogamer who kind of breaks down a little bit what this game is. Lives of P looks like Bloodborne with Pinocchio as the playable character. Published by NeoWiz and developed by Round 8 Studio, Lives of P has a brutal and dark world and the kind of action role-playing gameplay established by From Software's Soul series. It's inspired by the classic Italian novel Pinocchio from Carlo Collodi, and is set in the once beautiful city of Kratz. You fight, quote, hideous and twisted automatons as P searches for Mr. Geppetto and works to reverse the calamity that has befallen Kratz. Round 8 Studio is the developer of Bless Unleashed, which launched on consoles last year and PC this year. Lives of P is its second title. Expect a release on PC and consoles. There's no release window, but this one looks like it's worth keeping an eye on. And I agree, this trailer, as somebody who recently got super into Bloodborne, and Bloodborne is at this point probably one of my favorite games, top 30 at this point. Watching this trailer, I was pulled in. I was like, oh shit, this looks really good. The combat looks really slick. The character animations look a lot like Bloodborne character animations, but I love the idea that it is adapted from the original classic Pinocchio story and you're playing as Pinocchio and it has like this dark, brutal tone to it. I'm in love with it.
It's a dark and gritty Pinocchio in the style of Bloodborne. I mean, that'll get your attention, right?
That got my attention immediately. It sounds cool. It looks super dope. And yeah, it's kind of come out of nowhere. And so like, I can't wait to like keep up with updates on this one and see if the final game pans out as being actually like really good. I really hope it is. But Gary, the release of Lies of P is probably just so far away. If I want to know what's coming out to Mom and Grop shops today, where would I look?
The official list of upcoming software on each and every platform as listed by the Kinda Funny Games Daily Show host each and every weekday.
Yeah. Out today, we got Airborne Kingdom for PS5, PS4, Xbox Series X, Xbox One, and Switch. Disney Classic Games Collection for PS4, Xbox One, Switch, and PC. Football Manager 2022 for Xbox One and PC. Forza Horizon 5 for Xbox Series X, Xbox One, and PC. Jurassic World Evolution 2 for PS5, PS4, Xbox Series X, Xbox One, and PC. Blue Reflections Second Light for Switch, and then My Singing Monsters Playground for Switch. We've got an NVIDIA GeForce update for you. Remember that we've partnered with NVIDIA to keep you updated on all the latest GeForce RTX additions to your favorite games, from ray tracing to NVIDIA DLSS to NVIDIA Reflex. NVIDIA DLSS is now accelerating performance with uncompromised image quality in over 120 games and apps, with even more being added every month, including Jurassic World Evolution 2. Remember, that is out now. Accelerate performance by up to 60% at 4K with max settings enabled using NVIDIA DLSS. You can also play Jurassic World Evolution 2 at launch via GeForce Now, NVIDIA's cloud gaming service. GeForce Now gives your low-end rig power to play Jurassic World Evolution 2 with NVIDIA DLSS streaming from the cloud. New dates for you. Breakwater's launch has been delayed to December 9th. We do have a deal of the day. The PC version of Assassin's Creed Chronicles Trilogy is currently free to download on Ubisoft Connect, so you can get that whole trilogy for free on PC. Again, go to the Ubisoft website or the Ubisoft Connect app to get that. Now it's time to squad up. Remember, you can go to patreon.com/kindoffunnygames where you can get the show ad-free and you can ride in with your squad ups just like Adam F. did. Adam F. wrote in with a squad up on Xbox and says, I recently managed to acquire an Xbox Series X in anticipation for the hype first-party games coming this year. Today, Forza Horizon 5 is released for Game Pass members, and I am so stoked to speed through the gorgeous Mexican landscape. My friends list is a little sparse, so I'd love to fill it up with some kind of funny best friends. Please feel free to add me at Watson001. That is WATS0N001. So we can smash each other's times and records. All the best, Adam F. Go squad up. Have a great time playing Forza Horizon 5. Now it's time for kindoffunny.com/you're wrong, where you write in and listen to what we got wrong as we got it wrong so we can correct it for those watching later on YouTube and listening later on podcast services around the globe. Nina Biologist writes in and says, a reminder that The Artful Escape is on Game Pass. So there you go.
Yeah, and there's no, you got no excuse.
No excuse. If you want to play The Artful Escape, you can do it right now.
And it's on Steam as well on PC.
Also, The Forgotten City is on Game Pass. Everybody go play The Forgotten City. It's a very good game. Nano also writes in and says, the Distortion World was a Pokemon Platinum feature that was the location of the game's primary legendary, Giratina. It's one of the few things that appear to have carried over from Platinum into this remake. So there you go. Some context for you. Today is Tuesday, means tomorrow is Wednesday, and your hosts for tomorrow are Tim and Andy. If you're watching this live on Twitch right now, after this is Forza Horizon 5 with Nick, Mike, and Andy. If you want to catch that stream later, you can subscribe to youtube.com/kindoffunnyplays. Remember, this has been Kind of Funny Games Daily. Remember, or each and every weekday live right here on twitch.tv/kindoffunnygames, we run you through the nerdy news you need to know about. We have a Patreon post show for those that are subbed at the silver level of patreon.com/kindoffunnygames, so stick around for that.
Hey, otherwise, is there a kind of funny Forza Horizon club? Because I'm looking to join a club.
Ooh, that's a really good question. I actually don't know. I might hit up Snowback Mike about that because that seems like a Snowback Mike thing. I think he would.
Yeah,
be
maybe
I should
create one. I'll join it. I'm looking for one.
Let's figure that out. What do you get with a club?
I'm not sure, but it's like, you know, it's like being in a clan or whatever. You can do events together. I'm not entirely sure how it works, but it's a thing. I'm looking to join one, so it may as well be, you know, if there's a kind of funny one.
Yeah, we got to get that going. Let's get that going. Until next time, it's been our pleasure to serve you.